We are going to get underway. I've got a handout. Hopefully you have that. And as I mentioned, we'll try to move through this as well as we can. We are stepping into a very intriguing part of Israel's history as we have gone through. I think not last week, but the week before, you spoke about kind of the Davidic kingdom and the Solomonic kingdom. You talked a little bit about where those things had been left off. How things had been going. And then prior to that, the conquest and settlement stage that followed the Exodus. And this moves us along rather quickly into what is perhaps some of the most difficult days in the history of Israel, because as a nation during this time period, Israel ultimately goes into oblivion. And they go from a place of being united, being doing well, seeing a lot of good things happening, to suddenly seeing that they as a people, are challenged, that they as a people are going through difficult times. And a lot of it comes out of what is actually very commonplace in history. If we look across the breadth of history, it still happens in today's world, but it's not as much, that when you come to a time where there's a transition in rulers, when you come to a time when there's a transition and who's in charge and who's capable, that you suddenly find yourself around people that could be having an agenda, trying to take things over, that you could be in a time where there's a lot of political and sociological upheaval. There could be times that political upheaval leads to militaristic upheaval, that leads to economic upheaval. And this is not entirely foreign to what is happening with Israel in this time. Israel is people that are in transition, and after the rapid, significant growth that happens under Solomon, the people of Israel are left with a situation that ultimately leads to two kingdoms. It ultimately divides them as a people and puts them into a different place and puts them into two separate kingdoms. Solomon's death is really the triggering point, and I'll have most of what I'll have on the back here will be in your notes. I have some maps and stuff that we'll touch on here in a few moments. Following Solomon's death in 922 BC, ends the stable period of the United Monarchy in Israel and begins a several hundred year spiral that ends in captivity. It's kind of an intriguing way that it goes. You get Israel as it's beginning, and it's in captivity in Egypt, and then now many, many generations later, Israel finds themselves in captivity again, even though technically it's no longer Israel, it's really just Judah that's in captivity, because that's all that remains. During this period of time, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom emerge. The northern kingdom is a group of tribes that split off and are in, not surprisingly, the north, and the southern kingdom is a pair of tribes that are left in the south. And the northern kingdom, what's often called Israel in the books of Kings and Chronicles, exists for another 200 years, while the southern kingdom, Judah, lasts until 586 BC. So this there is a little bit of a difference between the two. I'll tell you, the atlas that we have that accompanies the course does a really good job of plotting out a lot of what's going on in this time period. It does a really good job of kind of laying out some of the major details and really being able to put your arms around some of the quantitative data that happens in this space. Ultimately, during this period, the divided kingdoms went their separate ways and ultimately took a strong, united Israel and turned it into oblivion. This is the quintessential story of what happens. Really, we see this again and again in Scripture when brothers disagree. We had this with Jacob and Esau, where they split and they went their own way. Now it's the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. They split and they went their own way. Earlier it was David and Saul, and they split and they went their own way. You see this theme that gets repeated again and again, and it's very common in this time period. It's very common for what happens. So we see this kind of thing coming up occasionally. We also see this in history. Whenever there was a major change in a ruler, it always gave a window for people that were perhaps less than scrupulous to emerge and to rise up and to possibly overthrow that government or attempt to overthrow that government with what they had. During this period, what happens is we have some characters that show up. Now, what's intriguing is we go from a map. Now, this isn't in your notes. I've just got it here. We go from a map that looks like this at the end of Solomon's era. And at the end of Solomon's era, hold on for a second. At the end of Solomon's era, oops, it's not going to let me do that just completely yet. At the end of Solomon's era, you have a map that really resembles a lot of what we expect it to look like. We have a map that looks a lot of like we expect it to be, and you see some really critical features in that. One of them is that you see that Israel has its borders are fairly established. You'll see that this is kind of what we know largely as the modern political state of Israel. This is at the end of Solomon's kingdom. You do see some fractioning that's happening in here. Up in this area right here are the people of Phoenicia that exist here. You'll also see that this red line that goes all the way around is ultimately kind of the outline of what Solomon's community looks like. I will note that this map is not in the Atlas. I pulled it from another source because it's a really good, I think it's a good representation of what the Davidic and the Solomonic empires looked like. And you have a couple other features that get in there as well. You have the different regions that are going on. Obviously, the larger green part of this is kind of the Solomonic expansions that happen. The kingdoms of Edom and Moab and Ammon, they all kind of get absorbed into that as well. Phoenicia becomes a part, but they're not directly related. Philistia, which is right here, is another part. It's kind of like that little tangent off to the side that occurs on the map. This is a pretty standard map of what we would consider Israel to be. It is unsurprising that this is what would come out of the Solomonic and the Davidic kingdoms. Now, obviously, Solomon's reign became very important for Israel. During that time, I tell people all the time that Solomon was known for really three things. He was a very wise man that lived. He was a very wealthy man that lived. But he also was a very worldly man that lived. And we've gone through this in a lot of ways when we talk about the book of Ecclesiastes, when we did wisdom literature, maybe it was last semester or two. And we've talked a little bit about how Solomon portrayed himself and how he kind of came to grasp that his image was at the end of his life. So also we see this, that the seeds for this division had been sown during Solomon's reign with policies that proved irksome to the northern tribes. And we pick up with that. I'm going to go and I'll read you something here real quick. I try to give you as many cross-references as possible. Where you're going to kind of be located if you start reading along with this in Scripture is you're going to find yourself in the book of 1 and 2 Kings, and you're also going to find yourself in the book of 2 Chronicles. Chronicles is a bit different than Kings. It has a different purpose. Chronicles was probably written after the book of Kings was written, though there were some editorial features in Kings that acknowledge Chronicles. They're both history books, and they don't exactly lay next to each other in how they go about their task, and they have a different focus for what they're going about and how they go about these things. But what we run into is that there are a couple of policies that come about, and after Solomon's death, one of them that we see is that Solomon had a tendency to overtax, and he had a tendency because he was rooted out of Jerusalem to all the northern tribes. He would kind of send them the bulk of the tax rate because they were attached to more lavish isn't the right term, but probably more economically successful trade routes. They had a lot of things that were around them that fed in and provided for a lot of the economic resources. So Solomon would have a tendency to tax them a little bit more. I saw an interesting thing the other day. The Los Angeles Rams traded Aqib Talib from the Rams in California to the Dolphins, I think it was, in Florida. And Aqib Talib, they said it was a win-win-win trade. That usually never happens. Because the Rams got extra cap space, which is important. The Dolphins picked up a good cornerback under contract that's going to help them. and that Aqib Talib relieved himself of $750,000 in state income taxes by moving from California to Florida. Because sometimes we tax the opulent a little bit heavier than we do the everyday folks. And that's kind of an example of that. Here, what would have been happening with Solomon's period is he was taxing the northern kingdoms a little bit, or northern tribes, I should say, a little bit more than he was the southern tribes. And that was sort of starting to bother the tribes. Because, you know, these guys talk about things just kind of like maybe you talk to your neighbors about your property taxes that come up. Because this is kind of normal conversation. And you say, well, I'm paying a little too much here. Or, you know, maybe we're getting a good deal because those people across the street are paying a whole lot more. Those people in that other neighborhood have a higher mud tax or something along those lines. The thing that happens is that Solomon needed to finance his kingdom, and he tried to do it the best way a king knows how, which is tax people. Because you can really gain money two ways at this period of time. One, you can tax people. Or two, you can go conquer people. Because we didn't have innovative economic engines. You didn't have this way where the federal government could go and take, you know, $1.5 billion, put it in a bank account, and get 2% interest on it or something. That the reality is that there is only a few ways that you can really raise money. Now, there's a third way that you can raise money that's really hard, which is you can go find it in the ground somewhere and pull it out, melt it down, and suddenly you have money. Now, there's some things that go in that. We're not going to forget that because one of the characters that comes up here in a few moments comes out of that situation. But we see that in 1 Kings chapter 12. Let me pick up with this. I always recommend good resources. If you're looking for a good, I don't always recommend study Bibles for a couple reasons. One, because the notes have a tendency to be the same font as the scripture text. And sometimes we can confuse the inspiration. I know some of the guys that wrote the notes for this. They're normal, everyday people, good men and women. They're not inspired by God to write scripture, and they'll tell you that too. This does a good job. The ESV Study Bible does a good job of laying out a lot of good background content, a lot of good cross-references, a lot of good material. And what's good about this is they make a very good division between what is inspired scripture and what is a note. And they have a lot of really good maps that are laid in and all that kind of a thing. So I always encourage that. Plus, the ESV is a good translation and so forth. So, excuse me. So we pick up in 1 Kings chapter 12, and it starts with a character. Rehoboam had gone to Shechem, for all of Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. And as soon as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of this, for he was still in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon, then Jeroboam returned from Egypt. So you immediately have your first two personalities that come onto the scene in Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And even though their names rhyme, they are not, as best we know, related. Not that your names rhyming would make that the case. Notice what it says in verse 4 there. Let me pick up in verse 3. And they sent... and called him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, verse 4, your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. And he said, that's Rehoboam, said to them, go away for 3 days and then come to me again. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam took counsel of these old men who stood before Solomon and his father while he was still alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer these people? And they said to him, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. But he abandoned, that is Rehoboam, abandoned the counsel the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, what do you advise that I answer this people who have come and said to me, lighten the yoke that your father put upon us? And the men who had grown up with him, that is the young men, they said this, thus shall you speak to this people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you lighten it for us. You should say to them, my finger is thicker than your father's thighs. Now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. So my father disciplined you with whips, I will discipline you with scorpions. The wise men didn't have the best counsel this day. Because ultimately what happens is that Rehoboam takes his buddy's counsel and he goes back to the people of Israel that ultimately become the northern kingdom and he says those exact words. And he says that, and then verse 15, so the king did not listen to the people, for it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word, in which the Lord spoke by Ahijah the Shilonite and Jeroboam the son of Nebat. And one of the things that we run into here is we see that Rehoboam has a chance to lighten the load. Well, what load are we talking about? Well, he's talking about the load of tax, the taxation that is there. And it was a heavy burden. And keep in mind, these people are not wealthy people. They're not even middle-class people. These are poor, everyday people. And they have to pay a flat tax. They have to pay a certain amount of tax every year that is based upon what tribe they're a part of. And at that critical moment in history, just like we looked back a couple weeks ago when we looked at a very critical moment in history when we talked about the sons of Abraham, we talked about Isaac, we talked about Ishmael. Those critical moments in history that happen across the biblical epic, this is one of them, and we often overlook it because in this moment, Rehoboam has a chance to win back the people of the north. But ultimately what he does is he pushes them farther away. And what ends up happening is they split the kingdom because of this. And you'll notice this, that the two leaders that begin this stage are in the north, Jeroboam. Now, he was an Ephraimite who was exiled to Egypt. Well, it was his own exile or Solomon's exile. He was out in Egypt. He was running work gangs that were doing a number of different things, including going into the ground to try to find more gold. He had been able to gain a lot of notoriety. He had become a leader of people. And it's intriguing that at this moment in history, when there's a significant shift in power, that the people of the north reach out to him. They reach out to Jeroboam. They don't reach out to other people. They reach out to Jeroboam, and he comes and becomes the mouthpiece for them. A second person that comes onto this scene, we've already talked about, is Solomon's son, Rehoboam, who becomes his successor. He would lead the southern tribes. So Jeroboam the first, though he wasn't Jeroboam the first then, but Jeroboam the first is leading the northern tribes, and Rehoboam, who is Solomon's son, is leading the southern tribes. And ultimately what we get is this. This is what Israel becomes, and this is a map that I actually did take out. This is map 57 out of the atlas that we've got. This is actually what the tribes end up looking like geographically. Once they begin that process of splitting, once they get into that time where they do go and split. And you'll notice that there's a pretty even distinction between the people, the southern kingdom, which goes around here, and then obviously the northern kingdom that goes around here. So you see that there are two very, I think, fairly clear distinctions between the two. And that's where we kind of leave Israel for the next several hundred years. It's no longer united, but it's divided. There are two kings. There are two people there are two individuals that are ruling. I put in the notes a chart of the leaders that we have from Israel and then also from Judah, and was able to provide the different scripture references. You'll notice in the chart, just like we have back here, the ones that are in dark gray are the really good kings. The ones that are in light gray are the they weren't terrible kings, and everybody else is pretty bad. What do you notice about the coloring in that chart? There are not many good kings, because it's corruption happens pretty easily, and especially when you are the king. But you'll also notice that there's no good kings in the northern kingdom. There are no good kings in the northern kingdom. There's a king with Jehu who tries, but doesn't last for very long trying. Southern kingdom, though, the kingdom of Judah, has more good kings and has a pretty good split on the kings and the good kings with the not good kings in there as well. A couple characteristics. One of the things that happens ultimately, you'll see this in the notes, is that these two tribes develop uniquely apart from each other. The northern kingdom has a set of characteristics. The southern kingdom has a set of characteristics. There's a spiritual trajectory of the north. There's a spiritual trajectory of the south. And it happens from the moment that the kingdom gets divided. There's a great note in the Atlas about what Jeroboam goes and does almost immediately upon getting brought in, is he goes and creates a number of houses of worship. And they ultimately, a lot of these houses of worship become pagan centers. They become centers for worshiping foreign deities. In the South, they had a unique aspect that's in there, and we're going to touch on that in a minute, that they were really the spiritual center of Israel, and they retain that in this. A couple things about the characteristics of the North. One is that they're wealthier and they're more powerful. Also, that there's a large geographic area that they cover. We go back to this chart right here, and you see that that geographic area is significant. The other thing that we run into with this geographic area, and you can see it in the chart behind me, all of the red lines are major trade routes. How many red lines are running through the southern kingdom? None. How many are running through the northern kingdom? Let's see, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5. Yeah, we got a lot. So it's interesting, if you are driving anywhere and you want to go somewhere quickly, let's say that you wanted to go from here to Dallas, what would you take? 45. What else could you take? You could take 35 if you went all the way over. What if you took, let's see, what's a good, what if you went up to College Station? So yeah, go, yeah, and then and kind of headed north. You could make it to Dallas-Fort Worth, couldn't you? Would you want to do it that way, though? Well, now, I'm sorry, if you had to return to Mecca, I can understand if you had to go through College Station and you have to do that often. But let's say you wanted to go from, you know, from here to, there's any number of places that you want to go from. Now, you can take kind of the slow road. You can kind of take, you know, the road that you use. It's going to go through a bunch of towns. Maybe you want to go sightseeing. Or you can take the highway. And the speed limit difference matters because it takes what about, now let's say that we're not going with traffic and you leave to go to Dallas. How long does it take you? About 4.5 hours. You go the other way, how long does it take you? 6. Depends on how long you stop. Those kinds of things. Well, even in this day and age, these trade routes are the superhighways of their day and age. They're the superhighways where you get everything done. Now, if you are a commerce company, if you're a trucking company, which way are you going to send your truck? Are you going to send them on the slow road or are you going to send them on the fast road? Well, why are you going to do that? Schedule? Time? Gas, yeah, cost for the driver, all those things. Plus, it's going to wear on the brakes more. Man, you get cruising, that's what you want to do. If you weren't on a super highway in this day and age, it was a lot harder to make money, just like it is today with everything. Going back to our list, it was a large geographic area. It also bordered wealthy nations. A lot of the nations to the north, like Syria or Ammon, even up in that area of Phoenicia, they were much better off with what they had. And there were a lot stronger ports in this area as well. But the North struggled spiritually. They struggled spiritually. They didn't have good leaders. Even from the very get-go with Jeroboam the first, they didn't have strong spiritual leaders. They had people that knew how to tango with the people from other religions. They understood how to move back and forth on that. And ultimately, their leaders were corrupt. Their leaders were corrupt. We see that a lot. We see that how that works itself out. One of the most famous examples that comes out of the northern kingdom that happens is the tale of Ahab and Jezebel. That what they do with Naboth's vineyard that happens in the book of Kings. The corruption, the murder, stealing a man's vineyard and murdering him and those things that happen. It's really an amazing set of stories that come out of that. And the kings of the north come from 9 different families. That's another thing that's important here. There's not a lot of hereditary identity. It's very scattered. It's very all over the place. There's a lot of people that kind of their identity is in flux. Their identity is in different places. So we see that with the north. We see what goes on with that, that they run into problems. And ultimately what happens is within 200 years, of Solomon's passing, the north goes away. Well, what happens to the north? Well, we see that with Hoshea, which happens in 2 Kings 17. They had diminished so much that it wasn't very hard to conquer them. They had diminished because of intermarriage. They had diminished because they had gone into traveling outside of their area, going and being attracted to other places, other religions, other ways of being. They went out and went about with what they were doing, and they kind of went into dispersion, if you will. What happens to the northern kingdom isn't so much that they're conquered, because they are conquered. What happens to the northern kingdom is they kind of just dissolve, and the 10 tribes cease to exist. And they go into this dispersion that happens in a more indirect route. But we talked about the north. Now we'll talk about the south real quick. Well, this was comprised of two tribes. The north was comprised of 10 tribes. The south is comprised of 2 tribes. The north is comprised of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Benjaminites being famous for being what? Lefties. Yeah. The Ehud and Elgon story from the book of Judges, from the period of Judges. It's about left-handers. He hides his sword on the other side, and they never check his other side because they never run into a guy that could do that before, nevertheless. But Judah and Benjamin come together for this in the southern kingdom. One of the things we also see is that they're geographically isolated. If you go back to this map here, you'll notice a couple things. Now, depending upon how you flesh out this map, and where you put your borders, even though I know that Philistia is right over here, depend upon how you do this, one of the things that you immediately can pick up on, and particularly from this map that Briscoe puts together, is that Judah doesn't have access to water, does it? You wanted to be powerful in this day. You wanted to be economically resourceful. You wanted to have the ability to influence others. You needed to have some good ports. You needed to have the ability to have access to that main, the Mediterranean, if you will, to go out on the sea to be able to draw that up. The south didn't have that. They were more geographically isolated. They really had one trade route as well. And that trade route ran from the middle, from really Jerusalem, which isn't really the middle, it's kind of the north central, but runs from Jerusalem all the way down to the Red Sea. If you're looking at this map here, it really, this trade route, which is an indirect one, runs down this direction right here. And it goes all the way down to the Red Sea. It was popular amongst caravans, but it wasn't as popular amongst everyday traders, people that are coming in on the ancient Silk Road or something like that, people that are traveling from what is modern day. I'll give you an example of this. If you're traveling from, let's say you're traveling from over in this area right here, and you want to travel up and around, the best way is to follow the major routes, because doing this isn't possible, because that doesn't exist. And if you try that, I don't know if you've ever seen Lawrence of Arabia, which is a great movie, by the way, you're going to end up in a bad situation for a lot of reasons. But there's a lot of, for a lot of reasons. But one of the things that we run into is we see that as we do these things that, I'll just go back to the south then. That they didn't have a lot of ability to get out onto the sea. They didn't have that ability. But the south had good leaders. They had some good leaders. You look at that chart that's sitting right next to there, they had some good leaders. They had some leaders that were able to do exactly what they were supposed to do, which is keep the people focused, keep the people back to God. But they had a homogenous population. They didn't have a lot of travelers in and out. They didn't have a lot of travelers. In so many ways, one of the things that we see that mimics history, and when we look at the Civil War from the United States, is how different the northern states were from the southern states. In some ways, though it's not completely congruent, there's a similarity. The northern states were very industrial. The southern states in the Civil War were very much more agrarian. And we see that there's something that goes on with that. There are stronger ports in the north. There are weaker ports in the south. And we see that here as well. It's funny how that happens. Now, I will say this, that I think that's where the line gets drawn to a degree, just in terms of space, again, not that they're congruent. Because while in this characteristic, the south was, the southern kingdoms were the more spiritually grounded, I don't know if we could make that claim about the Civil War in America. But ultimately, we also see that leaders arise out of David's line. Except for one individual who is an interloper, and that person is, where did he go? This one right here. And let me get you the pen right here. Athaliah, who was an interloper, she was a queen, came in. She was not of David's line, but she is the only leader of the southern kingdoms who was not a member of David's line. But then ultimately, the bigger part of that is that they had Jerusalem. The southern kingdoms had Jerusalem. They had the spiritual epicenter. They had the what used to be the political epicenter of Israel. So we see the difference in the two kingdoms that works itself out. And I thought that this was animated. So there we go. One of the challenges that we run into as we get into this, though, is that we constantly run into people from the outside, entities from the outside that come and they challenge Israel. They come and they challenge the two kingdoms in different ways. And what becomes so intriguing, we just don't have enough time to do this, you could spend an entire semester walking through the different foreign countries, the different parts of the timeline of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, just to see how they work themselves out. One of the constant troublers of both kingdoms would be the Neo-Assyrian Empire that rises during this period and starts expanding its territory. Ashurnaspeel II brings the kingdom out of the shadows and rebuilds Kala as his capital. Now, what we're talking about here is we're talking about this map. And this is also in the atlas here. This kind of talks about the Neo-Assyrian Empire and how it expands. And we see that it's located in what is today modern-day northern Iraq, west-north Iran. There's a lot of stuff going on over in here right now, isn't there? This is this population right here. This is that area right there that I just circled. That's where the Kurdish people live. Kurdish people are the largest ethnic group without geopolitical representation. I did a trip to eastern Turkey about 10 years ago, or 11 years ago, actually, and we went about seeing the people, the Kurdish people, and it was an amazing place to be. Just so intriguing, though, that they're spread over such a wide, diverse region. They go across multiple geopolitical countries today, but this is where they have been for generations and millennia, and that they haven't moved. They haven't migrated outside of this region. But ultimately, this is the Neo-Assyrian Empire, and it begins really starting to grow. Tilgath-Pileser III is the one who brings the most significant expansion to the kingdom, including attacking Israel, and that is the northern kingdom in 733 and 732. And we read about this. Let me flip over. I'll go to 2 Kings 15:29 real quick, and I'll read this real quick to you. This gives you the biblical correspondent to what we're going to see. And in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tilgath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ijon, Abel Beth-Makkah, Genoa, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried the people off into Assyria. And Hoshea, this is verse 30, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and they struck down and put him to death and reigned in his place. And in the 20th year of Jotham, this happened in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. Now the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, behold, are written in the book of Chronicles of the king of Israel. And that's such an interesting little thing right there, because that's a perfect example in verse 31 of probably what is a later editorial addition to the text, because Kings is written outside of a time for Chronicles, and they mention Chronicles is going on. They mention a couple of the other things that are happening. And this, we're not how this all works. What happens here, though, is we see that the northern kingdom, this is what some scholars call Samaria, that are taken away. And what happens is that Tilgath-Pileser comes in and creates, he besieges the city, and then he ultimately goes in and he attacks Israel and takes a group of them off. And then in 722, Shalmaneser V besieges Samaria for 3 years before conquering the city. And you can see that again in 2 Kings 17. In the 12th year of Asa, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, began to reign in Samaria over Israel, and he reigned 9 years, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, yet not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Against him came Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria. And so again, we're seeing how these people are lining up with the historical timeline, things that we know, this is where the biblical narrative ties together. Ultimately, Judah survives this and becomes a vassal state to Assyria. And it is that they don't have a political direction of their own, but rather that they're vassals, that their whims are dictated to by somebody, an emperor or empire far away, and the people that they raise up to lead. It's a puppet government in some ways. And ultimately, until the fall of Ashurbanipal II in 627. And in 627, this is where the Assyrian Empire begins declining at a significant level and so forth. And they go through a very period of time. But Assyria becomes a very significant thing. And if you start reading a lot of the minor prophets, if you start reading through some of the biblical narrative in this time, you'll start seeing Assyria mentioned here and there and here and there. What's intriguing is Assyria was a significant foe to the northern kingdom, not so much to the southern kingdom for different reasons, but that Assyria doesn't obtain, at least in my read, the recognition that the next empire receives, which is Babylon. Babylon receives a significant attack, if you will, or not a negative press, if you will, in the biblical narrative, just because of the nature of how it was run. There's so many things that happen with that. So this is kind of the expansion, the rise of Assyria that goes through. You'll see a number of different campaigns that happen with these red lines. This is the zone of their influence. The next map that I want to put up, which is, again, this is in the atlas, this is the really the pinnacle of the Assyrian supremacy. You'll see that Assyria goes into a number of different countries that we know today, even as making it as far as Egypt, being able to conquer the Nile region, being able to go all the way into what is today modern day Turkey up in here. And they've spread around very significantly, throughout what is now the Middle Eastern area, conquering or making significant inroads to a lot of the countries. Assyria becomes a major global power in this time. And then in 609, the Egyptians conquered Judah following the death of Josiah during a battle in Megiddo. Let me see, where is that? Oh, there it is, yeah, for 609. You'll notice in here, I also mentioned that the Assyrian Empire declines rapidly as the Neo-Babylonian Empire suddenly arises in what is modern-day Iraq. They are attacked by the Medes and the Chaldeans and conquered in 605. And in 605, Nebuchadnezzar assumes the throne of the Babylonian Empire. And that's a really significant feature because we have a lot of good dating for Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar becomes a very significant figure, in other biblical narratives that we've talked about in the past. A couple other pieces here real quick. Jehoiakim is appointed king of Judah by Necho II. Necho II is a king of Egypt. And for a while there, Egypt and Assyria were aligned. And as the Neo-Babylonians rise up, it really becomes the Egyptians and the Assyrians fighting against the Babylonians or the Chaldeans and the Medes, and what ultimately becomes the region that we know of today as Persia, becomes this. Now, Jehoiakim is appointed by king of Judah by Necho II. We can read about that if you want to in 2 Kings 23. The Babylonians take control in 605, and Jehoiakim rebels. And what they do is they come in and they kind of take over what is left of Judah. Now, at this point in the history of Israel, all that exists is left of Israel is the southern kingdom. There's not a northern kingdom because the northern kingdom has been dispersed. It's kind of been absorbed. It's gone into scattering with everything. And after Judah's defeat, Jehoiakim and others are taken into exile. You can read about this in 2 Kings. Let me grab a couple of verses here real quick. Because it's always intriguing to align these together. I'm not going to read all 16. Verse 1 in chapter 24 of 2 Kings. In his day, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim sent his servant, became his servant for 3 years. Then Jehoiakim rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and the Lord sent against sent against him the bands of Chaldeans and the bands of Syrians and the bands of Moabites and the bands of Ammonites, and sent them against Judah to destroy it. according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by his servants and the prophets. And surely this came upon Judah at the command of the Lord to remove them out of his sights for the sin of Manasseh, according to all that they had done, and for the innocent blood that he had shed. For he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not pardon it. So we automatically see that there is a description of how the southern kingdom becomes being taken over that happens in the book of 2 Kings. Zedekiah rebels a little later on in a second exile. So you're in the phase this first exile occurs, and the exiles are taken from Jerusalem. And you can actually see this in the waves of the exiles. They're taken from Jerusalem, which is over right here, and they're taken up into the major routes, and they're brought back to Babylon. That happens not once, not twice, but three times. And ultimately, through all of that, it removes what is left of the southern kingdom, and they go back and forth. This is we don't do this today in our nations. We haven't done this in a long time, but this is a very effective way of destroying a people. If you just take them and you remove them into your people, you're able to capture the good things of their culture, and then you're able to absorb them and ultimately destroy them by replanting your culture into theirs. It's a significant way of removing a people. Zedekiah rebels, and a second exile occurs. And then in 586, Jerusalem is sacked, and the first temple is destroyed. Now, this is a very significant moment because the first temple, the Solomonic temple, the promise of God that had stood for that so many hundreds of years is sacked. It's destroyed. It's destroyed while Jerusalem is sacked. And the first temple period is a significant marker. What happens in Jesus' day is you have the first temple period, and Jesus' day you have the Herodian temple, the rebuilt temple. The people of God, the people of Israel that gather there are gathering in the Herodian temple. That is the second temple. And there's a significant amount of work being done right now on the difference between Second Temple Judaism and First Temple Israelite religion. That really feeds into how different the New Testament context is for everything. And then finally, the final exile happens in 582, and Judah is lost. And 582 signals the third and final. One of the books that comes after this period, one of the first ones, is the book of Nehemiah that goes on. So again, we're not necessarily looking inherently at the books of the Old Testament being set up chronologically, but Nehemiah comes into that as well as Ezra that comes out of that as well. The book of Daniel is primarily located in the Babylonian Empire, and there's a lot of some data that goes on along that line. Again, this is kind of the rise of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. This is a good map. It's available in the Atlas. And you can kind of see what happens. This is really modern-day Iraq right here. You have the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that are flowing in and out of what is the Persian Gulf. You can kind of see how this all goes. And the Babylonian Empire becomes so significant. You go and you read the book of Revelation, and you'll start reading about Babylon. You'll start reading about why is Babylon the prototypical anti-God people. Well, it's because of the history, the lineage of what's going on with the people of Israel in this time. They were taken from their promised land. Notice that. They were taken from their promised land. The promised temple is destroyed. The promised city is destroyed. The promised people are no longer. And that they have to go into this pagan place where they're consumed and absorbed, and their religion is taken up against. It's a very scary place to be. It's a very dangerous place to be. And you'll see that that happens. A couple last little things, and we'll wrap up or go to questions. I tried to locate a number of the prophets, the major prophets of the Old Testament along this timeline, because this is extremely important to do. You'll see here in the 9th century, we have Elijah and Elisha. With their operable ministries. In the 8th century, which is the 700s, we have Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah. And then in the 7th century, we have Nahum, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, and Jeremiah. Now, you'll probably also ask, where's Micah? Where's Obadiah? Where's Zephaniah? Zephaniah is up there. Where's Malachi? Well, Malachi comes a little bit later. Where's Jonah? Because Jonah's story is located amongst this timeline as well. The challenge is, then we talked about this when we went through a couple semesters ago, the minor prophets. is that it's hard for us to locate some of these minor prophets within this narrative with a degree of definiteness, just because there's not a lot of information in the book. They have a really interesting book that speaks to us today. There's just not a lot of really good information that helps us locate that in the book the Minor Prophets book of the Bible. And ultimately, we leave it at this. We leave it at that. A divided kingdom stage is a tumultuous period in the life of Israel. What is left at the time of the Babylonian captivity is a hollow shell of what was a great united people of God. And this is the danger that we've had. This is the danger we always have, is that how can we go from a united people to a divided people so quickly? They did this in one generation. They did this in half a breadth of a generation. A generation, 16 years. You figure it takes 16 years to have a generation. I'm sorry, 16 years to have a generation. It's amazing to me that you're able to run through this and you're within a few years able to deviate from the promised people of God in the united monarchy around a king who is a good ruler and into oblivion within a couple hundred years. It's just astounding to me. It's just amazing to see how that happens with everything. So with all that said, I just wanted to see if you guys had any thoughts or any questions before we wrap up.
So it really became a democracy only after the United Nations set up Israel.
So when does Israel become a democracy? So this gets me into my place where I get into trouble occasionally. Because I think we have to separate political Israel from spiritual Israel. There is nothing in the Old Testament, I'll just be honest, other than the way that the early church ran itself. There's not much of democracy in the Bible, period, because they just didn't have access to that system. Though the Greeks, we'll talk about this in a couple of weeks, though the Greek city-states and the Greek Republic model that to a degree for us, it's just not a political system that has access. I would suggest to you that the Israel that's reconstituted by the UN is a geopolitical entity. And I think we need to be very careful with the next phrase that bears little spiritual resemblance to the Israel of the Old Testament. So I want to be careful with that, because I know there are plenty of people who disagree with me, and I respect them, and I break bread with them often, but we disagree on this. So the modern day Israel is a form of democracy. That exists, and that was instituted after the UN in 1952, something around in that. 48, there you go, 48. The 1948, when it got reconstituted by then. What's funny is that we talked about this when we went through eschatology, that there was a lot of Americans pushing for a reestablishment of Israel, because why did they push for a reestablishment of Israel? So they could usher in the second coming of Jesus Christ. I'm not saying it hasn't happened yet. Well, I'm not saying it isn't happening, because certainly the second coming of Christ is coming. It's just been a little bit of a disappointment for those folks. One of the folks that I knew very well, actually, while I was doing college, that was dead set, this is what's going to happen. Didn't happen. So 1948, absolutely. It's a little bit different, I think. What happens, though, in the Old Testament is that you have monarchies, you have empires, you have kings, you have queens, you have vassal states, because that's what they had access to. And I don't believe it's a negative statement to say that, and I always want to be very careful about how we say this, that we have to take modern day events with a grain of salt and their location in the biblical narrative. But I say that recognizing that I could very well be wrong, because I could. And I probably am about a few things. So all that to say, it's a good question, Todd, so thank you for asking it, because we get that things confused a little bit. What else? Thoughts or questions?
Which of the three exiles was Daniel, the first one?
He could have been the first one. I'm not an expert on the book of Daniel. I will say that if memory serves me correctly, that he could have been in the first one, or he could have been born in exile. So it could be one of those two. But again, I'm not an expert on the book of the book of Daniel. But he is in exile where he is, in Babylon. So, absolutely. What else? All right. Well, very good. All right. Well, thank you guys for being here tonight. And I've let you out 5 minutes early so you can begin your quick drive to a closest television. So to see how Game 7 turns out, I'm pretty sure somebody's going to win the World Series tonight. So have a good rest of the evening.